Chapter 17. Hella, 2727. The ticking of his cane marked the Surgeon General's progress through the iron of the great cathedral. Even in the parts of the cathedral where the engines and traction mechanisms were audible, they heard him coming long before he arrived. His footsteps were as measured and regular as the beats of a metronome, the tap of his cane punctuating the rhythm, iron against iron. He moved with a deliberate arachnoid slowness, giving the nosy and the idle time to disperse. Occasionally he was aware of watchers secreted behind metal pillars or grills, spying on him, thinking themselves discreet. More often than not, he knew with certainty that he went about his errands unobserved. In the long years of his service to Quaich, one thing had been made clear to the cathedral populace. Grelier's business was not a matter for the curious. But sometimes those who fled from him were doing so for reasons other than the edict to keep their noses out of his work. He reached a spiral staircase, a helix of skeletal iron plunging down into the clanking depths of motive power. The staircase was ringing like a struck tuning fork. Either it was picking up a vibration from the machines below, or someone had just employed it to get away from Grelier. He leant over the balustrade, peering down the corkscrewing middle of the staircase. Two turns below, pudgy fingers slipped urgently along the handrail. Was that his man? Very probably. Humming to himself, Grelier unlatched the protective gate that allowed entry to the stairwell. He flipped it shut with the sharp end of his cane and began to descend. He took his time, allowing each pair of footfalls to echo before proceeding down to the next step. He let the cane tap, tap, tap against the balusters, informing the man that he was coming and that there was no conceivable avenue of escape. Grelier knew the innards of motive power as intimately as he knew the innards of every section of the cathedral. He had sealed all the other stairwells with the clock tower key. This was the only way up or down, and he would be sure to seal it once he reached the bottom. His heavy medical case knocked against one thigh as he descended, in perfect synchrony with the tapping of the cane. The machines in the lower levels sang more loudly as he approached them. There was no part of the cathedral where you couldn't hear those grinding mechanisms, if there were no other sounds. But in the high levels, the noise from the motors and traction systems had to compete with organ music and the permanently singing voices of the choir. The mind soon filtered out that faint background component. Not here. Grelier heard the shrill whine of turbines, which set his teeth on edge. He heard the low clank and thud of massive articulated cranks and eccentrics. He heard pistons sliding, valves opening and closing. He heard relays chattering, the low voices of technical staff. He descended, cane tapping, medical kit ready. Grelier reached the lowest turn of the spiral. The exit gate squeaked on its hinges. It hadn't been latched. Someone had been in a bit of a hurry. He stepped through the doorframe and placed his medical kit between his shoes. He took the key from his breast pocket and locked the gate, preventing anyone from ascending from this level. Then he picked up the medical kit and resumed his leisurely progress. Grelier looked around. There was no sign of the fugitive, but there were plenty of places where a man might hide. This did not concern Grelier. In time he was bound to find the pudgy-fingered absconder. He could allow himself a few moments to look around, take a break from his usual routine. He did not come down here all that often, and the place always impressed him. Motive power occupied one of the largest chambers of the cathedral, on the lowest pressurized level. The chamber ran the entire 200-meter length of the moving structure. It was 100 meters wide and 50 meters from floor to magnificently arched ceiling. Machinery filled much of the available volume, except for a gap around the walls and another of a dozen or so meters below the ceiling. The machinery was immense. It lacked the impersonal abstract vastness of starship mechanisms, but there was something more intimate and therefore more personally threatening about it. Starship machinery was vast and bureaucratic. It just didn't notice human beings. If they got on the wrong side of it, they simply ceased to exist, annihilated in a painless instant. But as huge as the machinery in motive power was, it was also small enough to notice people. If they got in the way of it, they were liable to find themselves maimed or crushed. It wouldn't be painless, and it wouldn't be instantaneous. Grelier pushed his cane against the pale green carapace of a turbine. Through the cane he felt the vigorous thrum of trapped energies. He thought of the blades whisking round, drawing energy from the superheated steam spewing from the atomic reactor. All it would take was a flaw in one of the blades, and the turbine could blow apart at any instant, bringing whirling, jagged death to anyone within 50 meters. It happened now and then. He usually came down to clean up the mess. It was all rather thrilling, really. The reactor, the cathedral's atomic power plant, was the largest single chunk of machinery in the chamber, housed in a bottle green dome at the rear end of the room. The kindest thing you could say about it was that it worked, and it was cheap. There was no nuclear fuel to be mined on Hela, but the Ultras provided a ready supply. Dirty and dangerous, maybe, but more economical than antimatter and easier to work with than a fusion power plant. They had done the calculations. Refining local ice to provide fusion fuel would have required a pre-processing plant as large as the entire existing motive power assembly. But the cathedral had already grown as big as it ever could, given the dimensions of the way and the devil's staircase. Besides, the reactor worked and supplied all the power that the cathedral required, and the reactor workers didn't get sick all that often. From the reactor's apex sprouted a tangle of high-pressure steam pipes. The gleaming silver intestines traversed the entire chamber, subject to inexplicable hairpin bends and right angles. They fed into 32 turbines, stacked atop one another in two rows, each row 8 turbines long. Catwalks, inspection platforms, access tunnels, ladders and equipment elevators caged the whole humming mass. The turbines were dynamos, converting the rushing steam into electrical power. They fed the electrical energy into the main traction motors, 24 of them squatting atop the turbines in two rows of 12. The traction motors in turn converted the electrical energy into mechanical force, propelling the great cranked and hinged mechanisms that ultimately moved the cathedral along the way. At any one time, only 10 of the 12 motors on one side were doing any work. The spare set was idling, ready to be connected into use if another motor or set of motors needed to be taken offline for overhaul. The mechanisms themselves passed overhead, extending from the traction motors to the walls on either side. They penetrated the walls via pressure-proofed gaskets positioned at the precise rocking points of the main coupling rods. The gaskets were troublesome, Grelier gathered. They were always failing and having to be replaced. But somehow or other the mechanical motion generated inside the motive power chamber had to be conveyed beyond the walls, into the vacuum. Above him, with a dreamlike slowness, the coupling rods swept back and forth and up and down in orchestrated waves, beginning at the front of the chamber and working back. A complicated arrangement of smaller cranks and eccentrics connected the rods to each other, synchronizing their movements. Aerial catwalks threaded between the huge spars of thrusting metal, allowing workers to lubricate joints and inspect failure points for metal fatigue. It was risky work. One moment of inattention and there'd be lubrication of entirely the wrong sort. There was more to motive power, of course, a lot more. Somewhere there was even a small foundry, working day and night to fabricate replacement parts. The largest components had to be made in wayside plants, but it always took time to procure and deliver such replacements. The artisans in motive power took great pride in their ingenuity when it came to fixing something at short notice, or pressing a part into service for a different function than intended. They knew what the bottom line was. The cathedral had to keep moving no matter what. No one was asking the world of them. It only had to move a third of a meter a second, after all. You could crawl faster than that, easily. The point was not the speed, but that the cathedral must never, ever stop. "Surgeon General, might I help you?" Grelier tracked the voice to its source. Someone was looking down at him from one of the catwalks above. The man wore the grey overalls of motive power and was gripping the handrail with oversized gloves. His bullet-shaped scalp was blue with stubble, a filthy neckerchief around his collar. Grelier recognized the man as Glaur, one of the shift bosses. "Perhaps you could come down here for a moment," Grelier said. Glaur complied immediately, traversing the catwalk and vanishing back into the machinery. Grelier tapped his cane idly against the cleated metal floor, waiting for the man to make his way down. "Something up, Surgeon General?" Glahr asked when he arrived. "I'm looking for someone," Grelier told him. No need to say why. "He won't belong down here, Glahr. Have you seen anyone unexpected?"
"Like who?"
"The choir, Master. I'm sure you know the fellow. Pudgy hands." Glahr looked back up to the slowly threshing coupling rods. They moved like the oars of some biblical galleon, manned by hundreds of slaves. Grelier imagined that Glahr would much rather be up there working with the predictable hazards of moving metal than down here navigating the shifting treacheries of cathedral politics.
"There was someone," Glahr offered. "I saw a man move through the hall a few minutes ago."
"Seemed in a bit of a rush, did he?" "I assumed he was on clock tower business."
"He wasn't. Any idea where I might find him now?"
Glahr glanced around. "He might have taken one of the staircases back up to the main levels."
"Not likely. He'll still be down here, I think. In which direction was he moving when you saw him?"
A moment of hesitation, which Grelier duly noted.
"Towards the reactor," Glahr said.
"Thank you."
Grelier tapped his cane smartly and left the shift boss standing there, his momentary usefulness over. He followed his quarry's path towards the reactor. He resisted the temptation to pick up his pace, maintaining his stroll, tapping the cane against the floor or any suitably resonant thing he happened to pass. Now and then he stepped over a glassed, grilled window in the floor and paused a while to watch the faintly lit ground crawl beneath him, 20 meters below. The cathedral's motion was rock-steady, the jerky walking motion of the 20 buttressed treads smoothed out by the skill of engineers like Glahr. The reactor loomed ahead. The green dome was surrounded by its own rings of catwalks rising to the apex. Heavily riveted viewing windows were set with thick, dark glass. He caught sight of a sleeve vanishing around the curve of the second catwalk from the ground.
"Hello," Grelier called. "Are you there, Vostad? I'd like a wee word."
No reply. Grelier circled the reactor, taking his time. From above, its originator always out of sight, came a metallic scamper. He smiled, dismayed at Vorstad's stupidity. There were 100 places to hide in the traction hall. Simian instinct, however, had driven the choirmaster to head for higher ground, even if that meant being cornered. Grelier reached the gated access point to the ladder. He stepped through it and locked the gate behind him. He could not climb and carry the medical kit and the cane, so he left the medical kit on the ground. He tucked the cane into the crook of his arm and made his way upwards, one rung at a time, until he reached the first catwalk. He walked around it once, just to unnerve Vorstad further. Humming quietly to himself, he looked over the edge and took in the scenery. Occasionally he rapped the cane against the curving metal sides of the reactor, or the black glass of one of the inspection portholes. The glass reminded him of the tar-like chips in the cathedral's front-facing stained-glass window, and he wondered for a moment if it was the same material. Well, on to business. He reached the ladder again and ascended to the next level. He could still hear that pathetic lab rat scampering.
"Vorstad, be a good fellow and come here, will you? It'll all be over in a jiffy."
The scampering continued. He could feel the man's footfalls through the metal, transmitted right around the reactor.
"I'll just have to come over to you myself, then, won't I?"
He began to circumnavigate the reactor. He was on a level with the coupling rods now. There were none close to him, but, seen in foreshortened perspective, the moving spars of metal threshed like scissor blades. He saw some of Glahr's technicians moving amongst that whisking machinery, oiling and checking. They appeared imprisoned in it, yet magically uninjured. The hem of a trouser leg vanished around the curve. The scampering increased in pace. Grelier smiled and halted, leaning over the edge. He was close now. He took the top end of his cane and twisted the head 1/4 turn.
"Up or down?" he whispered to himself. "Up or down?"
It was up. He could hear the clattering rising above him, to the next level of the catwalk. Grelier didn't know whether to be pleased or disappointed. Down, and the hunt would be over. The man would find his escape blocked, and Grelier would have had no difficulty pacifying him with the cane. With the man docile,
It would only take a minute or two to inject him with the top-up dose. Efficient, but where was the fun in that? At least now he was getting a run for his money. The end result would still be the same. The man cornered, no way out. Touch him with the cane and he'd be putty in Grelier's hands. There would be the problem of getting him down the ladder, of course, but one of Glower's people could help with that. Grelier climbed to the next level. This catwalk was smaller in diameter than the two below, set back towards the apex of the reactor dome. There was only one more level, at the apex itself, accessed by a gently sloping ramp. Vostad was moving up the ramp as Grelier watched. "There's nothing for you up there," the Surgeon General said. "Turn around now and we'll forget all about this." Would he hell? But Vostad was beyond reason in any case. He had arrived at the apex and was taking a moment to look back at his pursuer. Pudgy hands, moon-calf face. Grelier had his man all right. Not that there had ever been much doubt. "Leave me alone!" Vostad shouted. "Leave me alone, you bloody ghoul!" "Sticks and stones," Grelier said with a patient smile. He tapped his cane against the railing and began to ascend the ramp. "You won't get me," Vorstad said. "I've had enough. Too many bad dreams." "Oh, come now. A little prick and it'll all be over." Vorstad grabbed hold of one of the silver steam pipes erupting from the top of the reactor dome, wrapping himself around it. He began to scramble up it, using the pipe's metal ribs for grip. There was nothing graceful or speedy about his progress, but it was steady and methodical. Had he planned this? Grelier wondered. It had been a mistake to forget about the steam pipes. But where would he go ultimately? The pipes would only take him back along the hall towards the turbines and the traction motors. It might prolong the chase, but it was still futile in the long run. Grelier reached the reactor's apex. Vorstad was a meter or so above his head. He held up the cane, trying to tap Vorstad's heels. No good. He had made too much height. Grelier turned the head of the cane another quarter turn, increasing the stun setting, and touched it against the pipework. Vorstad yelped, but kept moving. Another quarter turn of the cane, maximum discharge setting, lethal at close quarters. He kissed the end of the cane against the metal and watched Vorstad hug the pipe convulsively. The man clenched his teeth, moaned, but still managed to hold on to the pipe. Grelier dropped the cane, the charge exhausted. Suddenly this wasn't proceeding quite the way he had planned it. "Where are you going?" Grelier asked playfully. "Come down now, before you hurt yourself." Vorstad said nothing, just kept crawling. "You'll do yourself an injury," Grelier said. Vorstad had reached the point where his pipe curved over to the horizontal, taking it across the hall towards the turbine complex. Grelier expected him to stop at the right-angled turn, having made his point. But instead, Vorstad wriggled around the bend until he was lying on the upper surface of the pipe, with his arms and legs wrapped around it. He was now 30 meters from the ground. The scene was drawing a small audience. About a dozen of Glower's men were standing in the hall below, looking up at the spectacle. Others had paused in their work amongst the coupling rods. "Clock tower business," Grelier said warningly. "Go back to your jobs." The workers drifted away, but Grelier was aware that most of them were still keeping one eye on what was happening. Had the situation reached the point where he needed to call in additional assistance from blood work? He hoped not. It was a matter of personal pride that he always took care of these house calls on his own. But the Vorstad call was turning messy. The choirmaster had made about 10 meters of horizontal distance, carrying him beyond the perimeter of the reactor. There was only floor below him now. Even in Hela's reduced gravity, a fall from 30 meters onto a hard surface was probably not going to be survivable. Grelier looked ahead. The pipe was supported from the ceiling at intervals, hanging by thin metal lines anchored to enlarged versions of the ribs. The nearest line was about 5 meters in front of Vorstad. There was no way he would be able to get around that. "All right," Grelier said, raising his voice above the din of the traction machinery. "You've made your point. We've all had a bit of a laugh. Now turn around and we'll talk things over sensibly." But Vorstad was beyond reason now. He had reached the supporting stay and was trying to wriggle past it, shifting much of his weight to one side of the pipe. Grelier watched, knowing with numbing inevitability that Vorstad was not going to make it. It would have been a difficult exercise for an agile young man, and Vorstad was neither. He was curled around the obstacle now, one leg hanging uselessly over the side, the other trying to act as a balance, one hand on the metal stay and the other fumbling for the nearest rib on the other side. He stretched, straining to reach the rib. Then he slipped, both legs coming off the pipe. He hung there, one hand taking his weight while the other thrashed around in midair. "Stay still," Grelier called. "Stay still and you'll be all right. You can hold yourself there until we get help if you stop moving." Again, a fit young man could have held himself up there until rescue arrived, even hanging from one hand. But Vorstad was a large, soft individual, who had never had to use his muscles before. Grelier watched as Vorstad's remaining hand slipped from the metal stay. He watched Vorstad fall down to the floor of the traction hall, hitting it with a thump that was nearly muffled by the constant background noise. There had been no scream, no gasp of shock. Vorstad's eyes were closed, but from the expression on his upturned face, it was likely that the man had died instantly. Grelier collected his cane, stuffed it into the crook of his arm, and made his way back down the series of ramps and ladders. At the foot of the reactor, he retrieved his medical kit and unlocked the access door. By the time he reached Vorstad, half a dozen of Glauer's workers had gathered around the body. He considered shooing them away, then decided against it. Let them watch. Let them see what blood work entailed. He knelt down by Vorstad and opened the medical kit. It gasped cold. It was divided into two compartments. In the upper tray were the red-filled syringes of top-up doses, fresh from blood work. They were labeled for serotype and viral strain. One of them had been intended for Vorstad and would now have to go to a new home. He peeled back Vorstad's sleeve. Was there still a faint pulse? That would make life easier. It was never a simple business, drawing blood from the dead, even the recently deceased. He reached into the second compartment, the one that held the empty syringes. He held one up to the light, symbolically. "The Lord giveth," Grelier said, slipping the syringe into one of Vorstad's veins and starting to draw blood. "And sometimes, unfortunately, the Lord taketh away." He filled three syringes before he was done. Grelier latched the gate to the spiral staircase behind him. It was good on reflection to escape the aggressive stillness of the traction hall. Sometimes it seemed to him that the place was a cathedral within a cathedral, with its own unwritten rules. He could control people, but down there, amid machines, he was out of his element. He had tried to make the most of the business with Vorstad, but everyone knew that he had not come to take blood, but to give it. Before ascending further, he stopped at one of the speaking points, calling a team down from blood work to deal with the body. There would be questions to answer later, but nothing that would cost him any sleep. Grelier moved through the main hall on his way to the clock tower. He was taking the long way around, in no particular hurry to see Quaish after the Vorstad debacle. Besides, it was his usual custom to make at least one circumnavigation of the hall before going up or down. It was the largest open space in the cathedral, and the only one, save for the traction hall, where he could free himself from the mild claustrophobia that he felt in every other part of the moving structure. The hall had been remade and expanded many times, as the cathedral itself grew to its present size. Little of that history was evident to the casual eye now, but having lived through most of the changes, Grelier saw what others might have missed. He observed the faint scars where interior walls had been removed and relocated. He saw the tide mark where the original, much lower ceiling had been. 30 or 40 years had passed since the new one had been put in. It had been a mammoth exercise in the airless environment of Hela, especially since the old space had remained occupied throughout the whole process, and the cathedral had, of course, kept moving the entire time. Yet the choir had not missed a note during the entire remodeling, and the number of deaths amongst the construction workers had remained tolerably low. Grelier paused a while at one of the stained glass windows on the right-hand side of the cathedral. The coloured edifice towered dozens of metres above him. It was framed by a series of divided stone arches, with a rose window at the very top. The cathedral's architectural skeleton, traction mechanisms, and external cladding were necessarily composed largely of metal, but much of the interior was faced with a thin layer of cosmetic masonry. Some of it had been processed from indigenous Hela minerals, but the rest of it, the subtle biscuit-hued stones and the luscious white and rose marbles, had been imported by the Ultras. Some of the stones, it was said, had even come from cathedrals on Earth. Grelier took that with a large pinch of salt. More than likely they'd come from the nearest suitable asteroid. It was the same with the holy relics he encountered during his tour, tucked away in candle-lit niches. It was anyone's guess how old they really were, whether they'd been hand-crafted by medieval artisans or knocked together in manufactory nano-forges. But regardless of the provenance of the stonework that framed it, the stained-glass window was a thing of beauty. When the light was right, it not only shone with a glory of its own, but transmitted that glory to everything and everyone within the hall. The details of the window hardly mattered. It would still have been beautiful if the chips of coloured vacuum-tight glass had been arranged in random kaleidoscopic patterns, but Grelier took particular note of the imagery. It changed from time to time, following dictates from Quaish himself. When Grelier sometimes had difficulty reading the man directly, and that was increasingly the case, the windows offered a parallel insight into Quaish's state of mind. Take now, for instance. When he had last paid attention to this window, it had focused on Haldora, showing a stylized view of the gas giant rendered in swirling chips of ochre and fawn. The planet had been set within a blue backdrop, speckled with the yellow chips of surrounding stars. In the foreground there had been a rocky landscape evoked in contrasting shards of white and black, with the gold form of Quaish's crashed ship parked amid boulders. Quaish himself was depicted outside the ship, robed and bearded, kneeling on the ground and raising an imploring hand to the heavens. Before that, Grelier recalled, the window had shown the cathedral itself, pictured descending the zigzagging ramp of the Devil's Staircase, looking for all the world like a tiny storm-tossed sailing ship, or the other cathedrals lagging behind, and with a slightly smaller rendition of Haldora in the sky. Before that, he couldn't be sure, but he thought it might have been a more modest variation on the theme of the crashed ship. The images that the window showed now were clear enough, but their significance to Quaish was much more difficult to judge. At the top, worked into the rose window itself, was the familiar banded face of Haldora. Below that were a couple of meters of starlit sky, shaded from deep blue to gold by some artifice of glass tinting. Then, taking up most of the height of the window, was a toweringly impressive cathedral, a teetering assemblage of pennanted spires and buttresses, lines of converging perspective making it clear that the cathedral sat immediately below Haldora. So far so good. The whole point of a cathedral was for it to remain precisely below the gas giant, just as depicted. But the cathedral in the window was obviously larger than any to be found on the permanent way. It was practically a citadel in its own right, and, unless Grelier was mistaken, it was clearly portrayed as being an outgrowth of the rocky foreground landscape, as if it had foundations rather than traction mechanisms. There was no sign of the permanent way at all. The window puzzled him. Quaish chose the content of the windows, and he was usually very literal-minded in his selections. The scenes might be exaggerated, might even have the taint of unreality. Quaish, outside his ship without a vacuum suit, for instance, but they usually bore at least some glancing relationship to actual events. But the present content of the window appeared to be worryingly metaphorical. That was all Grelier needed, Quaish going all metaphorical on him. But what else was he to make of the vast grounded cathedral? Perhaps it symbolized the fixed, immobile nature of Quaish's faith. Fine, Grelier told himself. You think you can read him now. But what if the messages start getting even foggier? He shook his head and continued his journey. He traversed the entire left-hand wall of the cathedral, not seeing any further oddities amongst the windows. That was a relief, at least. Perhaps the new design would turn out to be a temporary aberration, and life would continue as normal. He moved around to the front of the cathedral, into the shadow of the black window. The chips of glass were invisible. All he could see were the ghostly arcs and pillars of the supporting masonry, The design in that window had undoubtedly changed since the last time he had seen it. He moved back across to the right-hand side and proceeded along half the length of the cathedral until he arrived at the base of the clock tower. "Can't put it off any longer," Grelier said to himself. Back in her quarters on the caravan, Rashmika opened the letter, breaking the already weakened seal. The paper sprung wide. It was good quality stuff, creamy and thick, better than anything she had handled in the Badlands. Printed inside in neat but naive handwriting was a short message. She recognized the handwriting. "Dear Rashmika, I'm very sorry not to have been in touch for so long. I heard your name on the broadcasts from the Vigrid region, saying you had run away from home. I had a feeling that you would be coming after me, trying to find out what had happened to me since my last letter. When I found out that there was a caravan coming towards the way, one that you might have been able to reach with help, I felt certain you would be on it. I made an inquiry and found out the names of the passengers, and now I am writing this letter to you. I know you will think it strange that I have not written to you, or any of the family for so long, but things are different now, and it would not have been right. Everything that you said was true. They did not tell the truth to start with, and they gave me the Dean's blood as soon as I arrived at the way. I am sure you could tell this from the letters I sent to begin with. I was angry at first, but now I know that it was all for the best. What's done is done, and if they had been honest, it wouldn't have happened this way. They had to tell a lie for the greater good. I am happy now, happier than I have ever been. I have found a duty in life, something bigger than myself. I feel the Dean's love and the love of the Creator beyond the Dean. I don't expect you to understand or like any of this, Rashmika. That's why I stopped writing home. I didn't want to lie, and yet I also didn't want to hurt anyone. It was better to say nothing. It is kind and brave of you to come after me. It means more than you can imagine. But you must go home now, before I bring you any more hurt. Do this for me. Go home, back to the Badlands, and tell everyone that I am happy and that I love them all. I miss them terribly, but I do not regret what I have done. Please, do that for me, will you? And take my love as well. Remember me as I was, as your brother, not as what I have become. Then it will all be for the best. With love. Your brother Harbin Else." Rashmika read it one more time, scrutinizing it for hidden meaning, and then put it down. She closed it, but the seal would no longer hold the edges tight.
Grelier liked the view, if little else. 200 meters above the surface of Hela, Quaish's room was a windowed garret at the very top of the clock tower. From this vantage point one could see nearly 20 kilometers of the way in either direction, with the cathedrals strung along it like artfully placed ornaments. There were only a few of them ahead, but to the rear they stretched back far over the horizon. The tops of distant spires sparkled with the unnatural clarity of things in vacuum, tricking the eye into the illusion that they were much nearer than they actually were. Grelier reminded himself that some of those spires were nearly 40 kilometers behind. It would take them 30 hours or more to reach the spot now immediately beneath the Lady Morwenna, the better part of a hella day. There were some cathedrals so far behind that even their spires were not visible. The garret was hexagonal in plan, with high armored windows on all 6 sides. The slats of metal jalousies were ready to tilt into position at a command from Quaish, blocking light in any direction. For now the room was fully illuminated, with stripes of light and shade falling on every object and person within it. There were many mirrors in the room, arranged on pedestals, sightlines and angles of reflection carefully chosen. When Grelier entered, he saw his own shattered reflection arriving from 1,000 directions. He placed the cane into a wooden rack by the door. Aside from Grelier, the room contained 2 people. Quaish, as usual, reclined in the baroque enclosure of his medical support couch. He was a shriveled spectral thing, seemingly less substantial in the full glare of daylight than in the half-shuttered darkness that prevailed in the garret. He wore oversized black sunglasses that accentuated the morbid pallor and thinness of his face. The couch ruminated to itself with thoughtful hums and clicks and gurgles, occasionally delivering a dose of medicine into its client. Most of the distasteful medical business was tucked away under the scarlet blanket
that covered his recumbent form to the ribcage. But now and then something pulsed along one of the feed lines running into his forearms or the base of his skull. Something chemical green or electric blue. Something that could never be mistaken for blood. He did not look a well man. Appearances in this case were not deceptive. But, Grelier reminded himself, this was how Quaish had looked for decades. He was a very old man, pushing the envelope of available life prolongation therapies, testing them to their limit. But the limit was always slightly out of reach. Dying seemed to be a threshold that he lacked the energy to cross. They had both, Grelier reflected, been more or less the same physiological age when they had served under Jasmina aboard the Gnostic Ascension. Now Quaish was by far the older man, having lived through all of the last 112 years of planetary time. Grelier, by contrast, had experienced only 30 of those years. The arrangement had been simple enough, with generous benefits where Grelier was concerned. "I don't really like you," Quaish had told him back aboard the Gnostic Ascension, if that wasn't already obvious. "I think I got the message," Grelier said. "But I need you. You're useful to me. I don't want to die here. Not just now." "What about Jasmina?" "I'm sure you'll think of something. She relies on you for her clones, after all." It had been shortly after Quaish's rescue from the bridge on Hela. As soon as she received data on the structure, Jasmina had turned the Gnostic Ascension around and brought it into the 107 Piscium system, swinging into orbit around Hela. There had been no more booby traps on the surface. Later investigation showed that Quaish had triggered the only 3 sentries on the entire moon, and that they had been placed there and forgotten at least a century before by an earlier and now unremembered discoverer of the bridge. Except that was almost, but not quite, true. There was another sentry, but only Quaish knew about it. Fixated by what he had seen, and stunned by what had happened to him, the miraculous nature of his rescue combined inseparably and punishingly with the horror of losing Morwenna, Quaish had gone mad. That was Grelier's view, at least, and nothing in the last 112 years had done anything to reverse his opinion. Given what had happened, and given the perception-altering presence of the virus in Quaish's blood, he thought Quaish had got off lightly with only a mild kind of insanity. He still had some kind of grip on reality, still understood, with a manipulative brilliance, all that was going on around him. It was just that he saw the world through a gauze of piety. He had sanctified himself. Rationally, Quaish knew that his faith had something to do with the virus in his blood, but he also knew that he had been rescued because of a genuinely miraculous event. Telemetry records from the dominatrix were clear on this. His distress signal had only been intercepted because, for a fraction of a second, Haldora had ceased to exist. Responding to that signal, the dominatrix had raced to Hela, desperate to save him before his air ran out. The ship had only been doing its duty by racing at maximum thrust to reach Hela as quickly as possible. The acceleration limits that would have applied had Quaish been aboard were ignored, but the dull intelligence of the ship's mind had neglected to take Morwenna into consideration. When Quaish found his way back aboard, the Scrimshaw suit was silent. Later, in desperation, part of him already knowing that Morwenna was dead, he had cut through the thick metal of the suit. He had reached his hand inside, caressing the pulped red atrocity within, weeping even as she flowed through his fingers. Even the metal parts of her had been mangled. Quaish had lived, therefore, but at a terrible cost. His options at that point had seemed simple enough. He could find a way to discard his faith, some flushing therapy that would blast all traces of the virus from his blood. He would then have to find a rational, secular explanation for what had happened to him, and he would have to accept that, although he had been saved by what appeared to be a miracle, Morwenna, the only woman he had truly loved, was gone forever, and that she had died so that he might live. The other choice, the path that he had eventually chosen, was one of acceptance. He would submit himself to faith, acknowledge that a miracle had indeed occurred. The presence of the virus would, in this case, simply be a catalyst. It had pushed him towards faith, made him experience the feelings of holy presence. But on Hela, with time running out, He had experienced emotions that felt deeper and stronger than any the virus had ever given him. Was it possible that the virus had merely made him more receptive to what was already there? That, as artificial as it had been, it had enabled him to tune into a real, albeit faint, signal? If that was the case, then everything had meaning. The bridge meant something. He had witnessed a miracle, had called out for salvation and been granted it, and the death of Morwenna must have had some inexplicable but ultimately benign function in the greater plan of which Quaish was himself only a tiny, ticking, barely conscious part. "I have to stay here," he had told Grelier. "I have to stay on Hela until I know the answer, until it is revealed unto me." That was what he had said, "revealed unto me." Grelier had smiled. "You can't stay here. I'll find a way. She won't let you." But Quaish had made a proposal to Grelier then, one that the Surgeon General had found difficult to dismiss. Queen Jasmina was an unpredictable mistress. Her moods, even after years of service, were largely opaque to him. His relationship with her was characterized by intense fear of disapproval. "In the long run, she'll get you," Quaish had said. "She's an ultra. You can't read her, can't second-guess her. To her, you're just furniture. You serve a need, but you'll always be replaceable. But look at me. I'm a baseline human like yourself, an outcast from mainstream society." She said it herself. "We have much in common." "Less than you think." "We don't have to worship each other," Quaish had said. "We just have to work together." "What's in it for me?" Grelier had asked. "Me not telling her your little secret, for one. Oh, I know all about it. It was one of the last things Morwenna found out before Jasmina put her in the suit." Grelier had looked at him carefully. "I don't know what you mean." "I mean the body factory," Quaish had said. "Your little problem with supply and demand. There's more to it than just meeting Jasmina's insatiable taste for fresh bodies, isn't there? You've also got a sideline in body usage yourself. You like them small, undeveloped. You take them out of the tanks before they've reached adulthood. Sometimes even before they've reached childhood. And you do things to them. Vile, vile things. Then you put them back in the tanks and say they were never viable." "They have no minds," Grelier had said, as if this excused his actions. "Anyway, what exactly are you proposing? Blackmail?" "No, just an incentive. Help me dispose of Jasmina. Help me with other things, and I'll make sure no one ever finds out about the factory." Quietly, Grelier had said, "And what about my needs?" "Well, think of something, if that's what it takes to keep you working for me. Why should I prefer you as my master in place of Jasmina? You're as insane as each other." "Perhaps," Quaish had said. "The difference is I'm not murderous. Think about it." Grelier had, and before very long had decided that his short-term best interests lay beyond the Gnostic ascension. He would cooperate with Quaish for the immediate future, and then find something better, something less submissive, at the earliest opportunity. Yet here he was, over a century later. He had underestimated his own weakness to a ludicrous degree, for in the Ultras, with their ships crammed full of ancient, faulty reefer sleep caskets, Quaish had found the perfect means of keeping Grelier in his service. But Grelier had known nothing of this future in the earliest days of their liaison. Their first move had been to engineer Jasmina's downfall. Their plan had consisted of three steps, each of which had to be performed with great caution. The cost of discovery would be huge, but, Grelier was certain now, in all that time she had never once suspected that the two former rivals were plotting against her. That didn't mean that things had gone quite according to plan, however. First, a camp had been established on Hela. There were habitation modules, sensors and surface rovers. Some ultras had come down, but, as usual, their instinctive dislike of planetary environments had made them fidgety, anxious to get back to their ship. Grelier and Quaish, by contrast, had found it the perfect venue in which to further their uneasy alliance. And they had even made a remarkable discovery, one that only aided their cause. It was during their earliest scouting trips away from the base, under the eye of Jasmina, that they found the very first scuttler relics. Now, at last, they had some idea of who or what had made the bridge. The second phase of their plan had been to make Jasmina unwell. As master of the body factory, it had been a trivial matter for Grelier. He had tampered with the clones, slowing their development, triggering more abnormalities and defects. Unable to anchor herself to reality with regular doses of self-inflicted pain, Jasmina had grown insular. Her judgment had become impaired, her grasp on events tenuous. That was when they had attempted the third phase, rebellion. They had meant to engineer a mutiny, taking over the Gnostic Ascension for their own ends. There were Ultras, former friends of Morwenna, who had showed some sympathy to Quaish. During their initial explorations of Hela, Quaish and Grelier had located a fourth, fully functional sentry of the same type that had downed the Scavenger's daughter. The idea had been to exploit Jasmina's flawed judgment to drag the Gnostic Ascension within range of the remaining sentry weapon. Ordinarily, she would have resisted bringing her ship within light hours of a place like Hela, but the spectacle of the bridge and the discovery of the scuttler relics had overridden her better instincts. With the expected damage from the sentry, ultimately superficial, but enough to cause panic and confusion amongst her crew, the ship would have been ripe for takeover. But it hadn't worked. The sentry had attacked with greater force than Quaish had anticipated, inflicting fatal, spreading damage on the Gnostic Ascension. He had wanted to cripple the ship and occupy it for his own purposes, but instead the vessel had blown up, waves of explosions stuttering away from the impact points on her hull, until the wave front of destruction had reached the conjoiner drives. Two bright new suns had flared in Hela's sky. When the light faded, there had been nothing left of Jasmina, or of the great light-hugger that had brought Quaish and Grelier to this place. Quaish and Grelier had been stranded. But they were not doomed. They'd had all they needed to survive on Hela for years to come, courtesy of the surface camp already established. They had begun to explore, riding out in the surface rovers. They had collected scuttler parts, trying to fit the weird alien fossils together into some kind of coherent whole, always failing. To Quaish, it had become an obsessive enterprise. Above him, the puzzle of Haldora. Below, the maddening taxonomic jigsaw of the scuttlers. He had thrown himself into both mysteries, knowing that somehow they were linked, knowing that in finding the answer he would understand why he had been saved, and Morwenna sacrificed. He had believed that the puzzles were tests from God. He had also believed that only he was truly capable of solving them. A year had passed, then another. They circumnavigated Hela, using the rovers to carve out a rough trail. With each circumnavigation, the trail became better defined. They had made excursions to the north and south, veering away from the equator to where the heaviest concentrations of scuttler relics were to be found. Here they had mined and tunneled, gathering more pieces of the jigsaw. Always, however, they had returned to the equator to mull over what they had found. And one day, in the second or third year, Quaish had realized something critical, that he must witness another vanishing. "If it happens again, I have to see it," he had told Grelier. "But if it does happen again, for no particular reason, then you'll know it isn't a miracle." "No," Quaish had said emphatically. "If it happens twice, I'll know that God wanted to show it to me again for a reason, that he wanted to make sure there could be no doubt in my mind that such a thing had already happened." Grelier had decided to play along. "But you have the telemetry from the dominatrix. It confirms that Haldora vanished. Isn't that enough for you?" Quaish had dismissed this point with a wave of his hand. "Numbers in electronic registers. I didn't see it with my own eyes. This means something to me." "Then you'll have to watch Haldora forever." Hastily, Grelier had corrected himself. "I mean until it vanishes again. But how long did it disappear for last time? Less than a second? Less than an eye blink? What if you miss it?" "I'll have to try not to." "For half a year you can't even see Haldora," Grelier had pointed out, sweeping his arm overhead. "It rises and falls." "Only if you don't follow it. We circled Hela in under 3 months the first time we tried. Under 2 the second time. It would be easier still to travel slowly, keeping pace with Haldora. 1/3 of a meter a second, that's all it would take. Keep up that pace, stay close to the equator, and Haldora will always be overhead. It'll just be the landscape that changes. Grelier had shaken his head in wonderment. You've already thought this through. It wasn't difficult. We'll lash together the rovers, make a traveling observation platform. And sleep? And blinking? You're the physician, Quaish had said. You figure it out. And figure it out he had. Sleep could be banished with drugs and neurosurgery, coupled with a little dialysis to mop up fatigue poisons. He had taken care of the blinking as well. Ironic, really, Grelier had observed to Quaish. This is what she threatened you with in the Scrimshaw suit. No sleep and an unchanging view of reality. Yet now you welcome it. Things changed, Quaish had said. Now, standing in the garret, the years collapsed away. For Grelier, time had passed in a series of episodic snapshots, for he was only revived from reefer sleep when Quaish had some immediate need of him. He remembered that first, slow circumnavigation, keeping pace with Haldora, the rovers lashed together like a raft. A year or two later, another ship had arrived, more ultras, drawn by the faint flash of energy from the dying Gnostic ascension. They were curious, naturally cautious. They kept their ship at a safe distance and sent down emissaries in expendable vehicles. Quaish traded with them for parts and services, offering scuttler relics in turn. A decade or two later, following trade exchanges with the first ship, another had arrived. They were just as wary, just as keen to trade. The scuttler relics were exactly what the market wanted, and this time the ship was willing to offer more than components. There were sleepers in its belly, disaffected émigrés from some colony neither Quaish nor Grelier had ever heard of. The mystery of Hela, the rumours of miracle, had drawn them across the light years. Quaish had his first disciples. Thousands more had arrived, tens of thousands, then hundreds. For the ultras, Hela was now a lucrative stopover on the strung-out, fragile web of interstellar commerce. The core worlds, the old places of trade, were now out of bounds, touched by plague and war. Lately, perhaps, by something worse than either. It was difficult to tell. Very few ships were making it out to Hela from those places now. When they did, they brought with them confused stories of things emerging from interstellar space, fiercely mechanical things, implacable and old, that ripped through worlds, engorging themselves on organic life, but which were themselves no more alive than clocks or orreries. Those who came to Hela now came not only to witness the miraculous vanishings, but because they believed that they lived near the end of time, and that Hela was a point of culmination, a place of final pilgrimage. The ultras brought them as paid cargo in their ships and pretended to have no interest in the local situation beyond its immediate commercial value. For some, this was probably true, but Grelier knew ultras better than most, and he believed that lately he had seen something in their eyes, a fear that had nothing to do with the size of their profit margins and everything to do with their own survival. They had seen things as well, he presumed, glimpses, perhaps, phantoms stalking the edge of human space. For years they must have dismissed these as travellers' tales, but now, as news from the core colonies stopped arriving, they were beginning to wonder. There were ultras on Hela now. Under the terms of trade, their lighthugger starships were not permitted to come close to either Haldora or its inhabited moon. They congregated in a parking swarm on the edge of the system, dispatching smaller shuttles to Hela. Representatives of the churches inspected these shuttles, ensuring that they carried no recording or scanning equipment pointed at Haldora. It was a gesture more than anything, one that could have been easily circumvented. But the ultras were surprisingly pliant. They wanted to play along, for they needed the business. Quaish was completing his dealings with an ultra when Grelier arrived in the garret. "Thank you, Captain, for your time," he said, his ghost of a voice rising in grey spirals from the life-support couch. "I'm sorry we weren't able to come to an agreement," the Ultra replied. "But you appreciate that the safety of my ship must be my first priority. We are well aware of what happened to the Gnostic Ascension." Quaish spread his thin-boned fingers by way of sympathy. "Awful business. I was lucky to survive. So we gather. The couch angled towards Grelier. Surgeon General Grelier, might I introduce Captain Basquiat of the Lighthugger Bride of the Wind? Grelier bowed his head politely at Quaish's new guest. The ultra was not as extreme as some that Grelier had encountered, but still odd and unsettling by baseline standards. He was very thin and colourless, like some desiccated, weather-bleached insect, but propped upright in a blood-red support skeleton ornamented with silver lilies. A very large moth accompanied the ultra. It fluttered before his face, fanning it. "My pleasure," Grelier said, placing down the medical kit with its cargo of blood-filled syringes. "I hope you had a nice time on Hela." "Our visit was fruitful, Surgeon General. It wasn't possible to accommodate the last of Dean Quaish's wishes, but otherwise, I believe both parties are satisfied with proceedings." "And the other small matter we discussed?" Quaish asked. "The reefer sleep fatalities?" "Yes. We have around 24 brain-dead cases. In better times we might have been able to restore neural structure with the right sort of medicine intervention. Not now, however."
"We'd be happy to take them off your hands," Grelier said. "Free up the casket slots for the living." The ultra flicked a moth away from his lips.
"You have a particular use for these vegetables." "The Surgeon General takes an interest in their cases," Quaish said, interrupting before Grelier had a chance to say anything. "He likes to attempt experimental neural re-scripting procedures, don't you, Grelier?" He looked away sharply, not waiting for an answer. "Now, Captain, do you need any special assistance in returning to your ship?"
"None that I am aware of, thank you."
Grelier looked out of the east-facing window of the garret. At the other end of the ridged roof of the main hall was a landing pad, on which a small shuttle was parked. It was the bright yellow-green of a stick insect.
"Godspeed back to the parking swarm, Captain. We await transshipment of those unfortunate casket victims, and I look forward to doing business with you on another occasion."
The captain turned to walk out, but paused before leaving. He had noticed the Scrimshaw suit for the first time, Grelier thought. It was always there, standing in the corner of the room like a silent extra guest. The captain stared at it, his moth fluttering orbits around his head, then continued on his way. He could have no idea of the dreadful significance it represented to Quaish, the final resting place of Morwenna, and an ever-present reminder of what the first vanishing had cost him. Grelier waited until he was certain the ultra was not coming back. "What was all that about?" he asked. "The extra stuff he couldn't accommodate."
"The usual negotiations," Quaish said, as if the matter was beneath him. "Count yourself lucky that you'll get your vegetables. Now, blood work, eh? How did it go?"
"Wait a moment." Grelier moved to one wall and worked a brass-handled lever. The jalousies folded shut, admitting only narrow wedges of light. Then he bent down over Quaish and removed the sunglasses. Quaish normally kept them on during his negotiations, partly to protect his eyes against glare, but also because without them he was not a pretty sight. Of course, that was precisely the reason he sometimes chose not to wear them as well. Beneath the eye shades, hugging the skin like a second pair of glasses, was a skeletal framework. Around each eye were two circles from which radiated hooks, thrusting inwards to keep the eyelids from closing. There were little sprays built into the frames, blasting Quaish's eyes with moisture every few minutes. It would have been simpler, Grelier said, to have removed the eyelids in the first place, but Quaish had a penitential streak as wide as the way, and the discomfort of the frames suited him. It was a constant reminder of the need for vigilance, lest he miss a vanishing. Grelier took a small swab from the garret's medical locker and cleaned away the residue around Quaish's eyes.
"Blood work, Grelier."
"I'll come to that. Just tell me what that business with the Ultra was all about. Why did you want him to bring his ship closer to Hela?"
Visibly, Quaish's pupils dilated.
"Why do you think that's what I wanted of him?"
"Isn't it? Why else would he have said that it was too dangerous?"
"You presume a great deal, Grelier."
The Surgeon General finished cleaning up, then slotted the top pair of glasses back into place. "Why do you want the Ultras closer, all of a sudden?
For years you've worked hard to keep the bastards at arm's reach. Now you want one of their ships on your doorstep.
The figure in the couch sighed. He had more substance in the darkness. Grelier opened the slats again, observing that the yellow-green shuttle had departed from the landing pad.
It was just an idea, Quaish said.
What kind of idea?
You've seen how nervous the Ultras are lately. I trust them less and less. Basquiat seemed like a man I could do business with. I was hoping we might come to an arrangement.
What sort of arrangement?
Grelier returned the swabs to the cabinet.
Protection, Quaish said. Bring one group of Ultras here to keep the rest of them away.
Madness, Grelier said.
Insurance, his master corrected. But what does it matter? They weren't interested. Too worried about bringing their ship near to Hela. This place scares them as much as it tantalizes them, Grelier.
There'll always be others.
Perhaps.
Quaish sounded as if the whole business was already boring him, a mid-morning fancy he now regretted.
You asked about blood work, Grelier said. He knelt down and picked up the case. It didn't go swimmingly, but I collected from Vostad.
The choir, master. Weren't you supposed to be administering?
We change of plan. Blood work. The office of the clock tower dedicated to the preservation, enrichment, and dissemination of the countless viral strains spun off from Quaish's original infection. Almost everyone who worked in the cathedral carried some of Quaish in their blood now. It had reached across generations, mutating and mingling with other types of virus brought to Hela. The result was a chaotic profusion of possible effects. Many of the other churches were based on, or had in some sense even been caused by, subtle doctrinal variants of the original strain. Bloodwork operated to tame the chaos, isolating effective and doctrinally pure strains and damping out others. Individuals like Vorstad were often used as test cases for newly isolated viruses. If they showed psychotic or otherwise undesirable side effects, the strains would be eliminated. Vorstad had earned his role as guinea pig after a series of regrettable indiscretions, but had grown increasingly fearful of the results of each new test jab.
I hope you know what you're doing, Quaish said. I need blood work, Grelier. More so now than ever. I'm losing my religion.
Quaish's own faith was subject to horrible lapses. He had developed immunity to the pure strain of the virus, the one that had infected him before his time aboard the Gnostic Ascension. One of the principal tasks of blood work was to isolate the new mutant strains that were still able to have an effect on Quaish. Grelier didn't advertise the fact, but it was getting harder and harder to find them. Quaish was in a lapse now. Out of them, he never spoke of losing his religion. It was just there, solidly a part of him. It was only during the lapses that he found it possible to think of his faith as a chemically engineered thing. These interludes always worried Grelier. It was when Quaish was at his most conflicted that he was at his least predictable. Grelier thought again of the enigmatic stained glass window he had seen below, wondering if there might be a connection.
"We'll soon have your writer's reign," he said.
"Good. I'll need to be. There's trouble ahead, Grelier. Major icefalls reported in the Gulveig range, blocking the way. It will fall to us to clear them, as it always does. But even with God's fire, I'm still worried that we'll lose time on Haldora.
We'll make it up. We always do.
Drastic measures may be called for if the delay becomes unacceptably large. I want motive power to be ready for whatever I ask of them, even the unthinkable."
The couch tilted again, its reflection breaking up and reforming in the slowly moving mirrors. They were set up to guide light from Haldora into Quaish's field of view. Wherever he sat, he saw the world with his own eyes.
"The unthinkable, Grelier," he added. "You know what I mean by that, don't you?"
"I think so," Grelier said, and then thought of blood, and also of bridges.
He also thought of the girl he was bringing to the cathedral, and wondered if, perhaps, just perhaps, he had set in motion something it would no longer be possible to stop.
"But he won't do it," he thought. "He's insane. No one doubts that. But he isn't that insane.
not so insane that he'd take the Lady Morwenna across the bridge, over Absolution Gap.